Well, before I begin my talk on the political thought of the Roman State Church, I want to call your attention again to some news items. This is taken off the internet. It's Dateline Naples, Italy. A flask of saint's blood appeared to liquefy Saturday in the hands of Naples cardinal, sparking immediate impassioned debate among Italians over whether it was a sign of divine favor for the cardinal in his loan sharking case. The blood of Saint Gennaro, patron saint of Naples, has been seen to liquefy hundreds of times, including regularly on the September 19th anniversary of his martyrdom in 305. This year, the event had added political importance given the cardinal's implication in the loan sharking case. I'll leave the whole news item out for anybody who would like to read it. Here's a second one, just to show that we don't want to pick on Roman Catholics at this conference. This one's about evangelicals. Evangelicals urge 40 days of fasting, and I'll just read a few paragraphs from this. For 40 days last year, Linda Krieger prepared dinner and sat down with her two sons at the table, but ate nothing. For 40 consecutive days, she fasted, swallowing nothing but liquids. Krieger said she was not on a diet, but on a religious mission to find guidance from God. Prominent evangelicals led by Bill Bright of Campus Crusade for Christ and Pat Robertson of the Christian Broadcasting Network, both of whom, by the way, are signers of ECT, are calling for 2 million Christians to join in a national 40-day fast beginning March 1 and ending April 9, the day before Good Friday, roughly coinciding with Lent, the period of penance preceding Easter. They quote Bill Bright here as saying, "Fasting and prayer is the atomic bomb or the hydrogen bomb of all Christian disciplines. Prayer has great power, but fasting with prayer has infinitely more power. Biblical accounts," he said, "show that God responds to the faithful who fast because it demonstrates true repentance, humility, and contrition." Evangelicals, Robertson said, are discovering that fasting is a way of coming before God and saying, "We really mean business. We're not just playing this time." An evangelist who thinks in terms of moving masses, Bright, 77, is the founder of Campus Crusade for Christ, an international ministry based in Orlando with an annual budget of at least $270 million and 14,000 employees. In 1996, he received the $1 million Templeton Prize for Progress in Religion. Charles Tolson received that also. Given annually to prominent religious figures by the investor Sir John Templeton. Some evangelical leaders say they're uneasy about Bright's campaign to promote fasting because the Bible says that people who fast should not talk about it publicly. So there are a few who have read the Bible among evangelicals. Here's another statement. This is from the British Reform Fellowship. It's a monthly newsletter that I get from Great Britain, and it has a lead story. This is the August 1998 issue. It has a lead story on the Roman Catholics' newfound unity with evangelicals over primary Reformation dogma. And again, just a couple of paragraphs from it. According to reports circulating in the Northern Irish press, world-renowned Anglican Calvinist evangelical Dr. James I. Packer was booked as main speaker last month at Lowe Memorial Presbyterian Church in Belfast. The theme of his lecture was Evangelicals and Roman Catholics in Relationship, Issues for the 21st Century. The Belfast Telegraph reports that some 130 mainstream Protestants and Catholics have agreed to become signatories to what amounts to a 16-page report on the nature of salvation, which entails an agreement between Romanists and Protestants on the issue of justification by faith alone. The signatories also urge Christians of both traditions to explore their common faith and to build up friendships and to build a joint witness in a divided society. Then they list some of the signatories to the statement. They quote a Presbyterian minister, a Reverend Montgomery, who said that he would not be associated with the traditional ecumenical movement, but, quote, He has no problem in being involved in this latest movement because the fact that well-known conservative evangelicals have been involved has given the whole exercise credibility. Now that's one of the major objections to people like Roger Nicole and J.I. Packer adding these names. Also, when I got home last night, I found in my mail some kind pastor had sent me a page from the program for the forthcoming meeting of the Evangelical Theological Society in Orlando next month. They're going to have a panel discussion, and the three panel members are Father Francis Martin, this is the Evangelical Theological Society, J.I. Packer, outstanding, every Christian ought to be there, and Robert Godfrey. Now, Francis Martin is professor of biblical studies at the John Paul II Institute for Studies on Marriage and the Family. He's a co-author of ECT2, The Gift of Salvation. J.I. Packer is professor of theology at Regent College in Vancouver, Canada. He's also a co-author of the statement. And those two are paired against Mr. Godfrey, who is president of Westminster Theological Seminary in California, and he's described as an evangelical with serious concerns about the document. I've seen Dr. Godfrey speak. He's an excellent speaker, and I just pray that he can handle these two Romanists at the meeting of the Evangelical Theological Society in Orlando. The moderator for the panel is the president of Reformed Theological Seminary, Luther Whitlock. And this pastor who sent it to me was appalled at what's going on in one of the leading evangelical, academic evangelical organizations in the U.S. I would also ask your prayers. I am a member of ETS, and I intend to be traveling to Orlando in November and presenting two papers. And I may have the opportunity to ask some pointed questions of certain leading figures who apparently are going to be on the program at the ETS meeting. Another piece of mail that I thought you might be interested in is a conference being co-sponsored by the Acton Institute for the Study of Religion and Liberty in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and Calvin Theological Seminary. It's a conference on Abraham Kuyper and Leo XIII. It's called A Conference on the Legacy of Abraham Kuyper and Leo XIII Commemorating Over a Century of Christian Social Teaching. That's what I intend to be talking about this morning, the social teaching of the Roman State Church. The keynote address for this conference, or the keynote speaker, is Archbishop Francis Xavier Nguyen Van Thuong, President of the Pontifical Council of Justice and Peace, the Vatican. They don't go for local priests. They get keynote speakers from the Vatican itself. The second keynote speaker is Mr. Charles Colson, Prison Fellowship Ministries. The third keynote speaker is Dr. Mark Knoll, Wheaton College. Mark Knoll is also a signatory of ECT. And then we have another keynote from the very Reverend Emma Ziba O.P., Superior of the Dominican Order in Poland. And then the speakers are a mixture from Calvin College, Calvin Theological Seminary, Fordham University, Regent College, the Free University of Amsterdam, the University of Tulsa, Christendom College, American Enterprise Institute, the Heritage Foundation, the Franciscan University of Steubenville, Yale Divinity School, and Emory University. A major conference in Grand Rapids at the end of the month. They're celebrating Reformation Day, October 30th and 31st, by doing their best to bury it, I guess. Well, this morning I'd like to talk about Catholic social teaching. I'll begin this morning by quoting some Roman Catholic scholars. I intend to furnish many quotations, and I do in the course of the paper, from the popes themselves. I do this in response to, in part in response to some critics who have complained that we're not giving equal time to Roman Catholics at the conference. Of course, we're under no moral or legal obligation to do so. This is still a free country, no thanks to the Roman State Church. They can have their own conference. In fact, they have many such conferences. I just told you about one of them. This conference, to steal a line from Rush Limbaugh, is equal time. Apparently, our critics are disturbed by the fact that what Christians are still permitted to hold conferences in which the Roman State Church and some of her works and manifestations are exposed and criticized and discussed. As I shall show from her own mouth, the Roman State Church, if she had her way, meetings such as this would be proscribed. Some of you in attendance would be arrested, questioned, and possibly imprisoned, while those of us who speak would be judicially condemned to prison, or perhaps to execution, all in the name of God and Jesus Christ. Let me begin by quoting one of the greatest Roman Catholic historians of the 19th century, John Edward Emeric Edward Dalberg, better known as Lord Acton. Perhaps you've heard the saying, power corrupts. Actually, his exact words are, power tends to corrupt, absolute power corrupts absolutely. The words are Acton's. He wrote them in a letter to an archbishop of the Anglican Church, Mandell Creighton, and his words referred to the power of the papacy. Acton was immensely learned. He knew several languages, wrote prodigiously, and was a member of the Roman State Church all his life. Acton kept a notebook of his research on the Inquisition in which he wrote, "The object of the Inquisition was not to combat sin, for sin was not judged by it unless accompanied by a theological error, nor even to put down error, for it punished untimely and unseemly remarks the same as blasphemy. Only unity. This became an outward, fictitious, hypocritical unity. The gravest sin was pardoned, but it was death to deny the donation of Constantine." Now, the donation of Constantine, of course, was a fraudulent document manufactured by Rome in order to bolster its claim to the political power. Men learned that outward submission must be given. All this was to promote authority more than faith, when ideas are punished more severely than actions. For all this time, the church was softening the criminal law and saving men from the consequences of crime, and the donation was put on a level with God's own law. Men understood that authority went before sincerity. Then in a letter to Mandell Creighton, this is what Acton wrote. "I cannot accept your canon, your rule, that we are to judge Pope and King unlike other men with a favorable presumption that they did no wrong. If there is any presumption, it is the other way against holders of power, increasing as power increases. Historic responsibility has to make up for the want of legal responsibility. Power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Great men are almost always bad men, even when they exercise influence and not authority, still more when you superadd the tendency or the certainty of corruption by authority. There is no worse heresy than that the office sanctifies the holder of it. For many years, my view of Catholic controversy has been governed by the following chain of reasoning." And notice these three principles. "A crime does not become a good deed by being committed for the good of the church. 2. The theorist who approves the act is no better than the culprit who commits it. 3. The divine or historian who defends the theorist incurs the same blame. To commit murder is the mark of a moment exceptional. To defend it is constant and shows a more perverted conscience." We shall keep Acton's principles in mind as we discuss Roman political and economic thought. Acton's political views were of such a nature that a group of Presbyterians organized the North British Review and hired Acton as the editor. And it was in the pages of that magazine that he published much of his anti-Roman writing, all the while a member of the Roman Church. In 1868, Acton wrote a long essay in the North British Review about the St. Bartholomew's Eve massacre, which began in France August 24, 1572. In the essay, Acton argued there was no evidence to absolve the Roman State Church of premeditated murder. He argued that it was not only the facts that condemned the papacy for this heinous crime, but the whole body of casuistry developed by the Roman State Church that made it an act of Christian duty and mercy to kill a heretic. Acton pointed out that only when the Roman State Church could no longer rely on force but had to make its case before public opinion did it seek to explain away its murders. He wrote, "The story is much more abominable than we all believed. St. Bartholomew's is the greatest crime of modern times. It was committed on principles professed by Rome. It was approved, sanctioned, and praised by the papacy. The Holy See went out of its way to signify to the world by permanent and solemn acts how entirely admired a king who slaughtered his subjects treacherously because they were Protestants, to proclaim forever that because a man is Protestant, it is a pious deed to cut his throat in the night." Acton described the Ultramontanes, the proponents of papal infallibility, as, quote, "an organized conspiracy to establish a power which would be the most formidable enemy of liberty as well as of science throughout the world," unquote. After studying the history of the Roman State Church, Acton wrote, "The papacy contrived murder and massacred on the largest and also on the most cruel and inhuman scale. The popes were not only wholesale assassins, but they made the principle of assassination a law of the Christian Church and a condition of salvation. The papacy is the fiend skulking behind the crucifix." To understand Acton's hatred of papacy, we must begin with the Roman State Church's theory of ecclesiastical and political authority. The Roman State Church pretends to trace its genealogy back to Peter, an ecclesiastical and historical fantasy. Rather, it should trace its genealogy to two other men, Diotrephes and Constantine. In fact, as I shall discuss in a moment, for nearly eight centuries, the papacy did trace its political power to Constantine, until Lorenzo Valla showed that the donation of Constantine was a forgery, probably committed by the papacy itself to bolster its pretensions to political power. The new Roman emperors, however, nearly 500 years after Valla demonstrated the forgeries, have yet to admit that their claim to political power and jurisdiction rests on forged documents. Turning for a moment from political to ecclesiastical power, the notion of the preeminence of one man in the churches was not a late development. Christians sometimes resist the notion that the origins of the Roman State Church might be found in the Bible. They should not. We are clearly told in the New Testament that Antichrist is already at work, and we can see him at work in such doctrines as forbidding to marry, forbidding to eat meat, free will, natural law, asceticism, and keeping the law as a condition of salvation. The Roman State Church structure might not have been completed for centuries. In fact, it is still not completed. But its beginnings can be traced to these doctrines and practices mentioned in Scripture. In his third letter, John mentions a man named Diotrephes. John reports, "I wrote to the church, but Diotrephes, who loves to have the preeminence among them, does not receive us. Therefore, if I come, I will call to mind his deeds which he does, prating against us with malicious words. And not content with that, he himself does not receive the brethren and forbids those who wish to, putting them out of the church." What Diotrephes was doing on a local level, even before the death of the Apostle John, other church leaders would attempt on metropolitan and regional levels, until after several centuries, the Bishop of Rome won the struggle for ecclesiastical power. The first pope was not Peter, as the Roman State Church claims. Diotrephes was a proto-pope. He was an ambitious and anti-Christian church leader who loved to have preeminence who prated against Christians with malicious words and who expelled Christians from the church. In his first and second letters, John had warned the early Christians that Antichrist was already working in the churches in the world. But though Diotrephes was a precursor of the popes, the aggrandizement of the Roman Church and its bishops and the development of a theory to justify papal power took centuries. After all, there's nothing in the scriptures that either expressly states or logically implies the primacy of the Church of Rome or the office of Pope in the Christian Church. Far from being divinely instituted, the Roman State Church is entirely a development of ambitious and unscrupulous men, their dupes, frauds, and forgeries. Now, I'm going to skip the section on the donation of Constantine and go over to page 32. Since this is a more timely, I give a lot of historical background there in those intervening pages, but this is a more timely topic. I thought I'd talk about the state church's relationship to fascism and Nazism in the 20th century. And I'll quote first from U.S. News and World Report. This is the March 30th, 1998 issue. It's an article beginning on page 34, entitled A Vow of Silence. The author is Susan Hedden, Dana Hawkins, and Jason Vest. And this concerns the goings-on in what is used to be called, well, part of it was Yugoslavia, Croatia, during World War II. There has been an investigation of where the gold taken from the victims of the Nazi genocide ended up. The writers of the article report that one state after another has opened its archives and banking records to aid the search, with one glaring exception, the Vatican. Last week, the Vatican issued an official statement calling for repentance over the failure of some church members to do enough to aid Jews during the war. It's those Dern members again. But the statement did not mention the mounting calls for an inquiry into the Vatican's financial dealings with the Nazis and their allies. So far, the Vatican has flatly refused to allow investigators access to its archives, despite repeated pleas from several nations and from Jewish groups. Skipping several paragraphs here, the Croatian connection with the Vatican, however, is the core of the new evidence that suggests the Vatican might have directly handled funds stolen from the victims of the Nazis and their allies. From 1941 to 1945, the Ustashas, this is the Vatican government established in Croatia, exterminated an estimated 500,000 Serbs, Jews, and Gypsies, and looted their property. They demanded ransom amounting to 1,000 kilograms of gold from all the Jews in Zagreb, only to ship them to concentration camps and kill them anyway. It is a matter of historical record that the Croatian Catholic Church was closely entangled with the Ustashas. In the early years of World War II, Catholic priests oversaw forced conversions of Orthodox Serbs under the aegis of the Ustasha state. Franciscan friars distributed Ustasha propaganda. Several high Catholic officials in Yugoslavia were later indicted for war crimes. They included Father Dragutin Kamber, who ordered the killing of nearly 300 Orthodox Serbs, Bishop Ivan Sarek of Sarajevo, known as the Hangman of the Serbs, and Bishop Gregory Roseman of Slovenia, a wanted Nazi collaborator. A trial held by the Yugoslav War Crimes Commission in 1946 resulted in the conviction of a half dozen Ustasha priests. The Jasenovac concentration camp, where the Ustashas tortured and slaughtered hundreds of thousands with a brutality that shocked even the Nazis. The Reverend Krunoslav Draganovich, a Franciscan, had been a senior official of the Ustasha committee that handled the forced conversions of Orthodox Serbs. The Jasenovac concentration camp was managed by a Monsignor of the Roman Church. If anybody would like a copy of the article, I can have copies made if you'd like to read about this. It goes on for several pages. It's one of the exhibits for the contention that the tradition of persecution in the Roman State Church is alive and well in the 20th century. It's not something that happened in the 9th or the 13th century and then ended. Here you have an estimate of from 100,000 to 500,000 persons being executed in the space of 4 years in one little area of the world, Croatia, where the Vatican set up a puppet government. Let me continue with the relationship between fascism, Nazism, and Romanism. One of the topics rarely discussed in polite societies, especially evangelical societies, is the Roman State Church's role in supporting the fascist and Nazi regimes of the 20th century. Occasionally, the media reports some further development. I just read you one, and the continuing story of Vatican collaboration with the fascists and Nazis. But these brief mentions are almost always followed by thundering silence. I haven't heard any statements from Charles Colson or J.I. Packer about these reports. Now, the Roman State Church has done her best to cover up her complicity in supporting some of the most notorious dictators of the 20th century. But sometimes publicity just cannot be avoided, despite the best efforts of the Vatican spinmeisters. The Associated Press carried one such story earlier this year, and I will not quote it. It concerns the Vatican gold again. The Roman State Church has repeatedly refused to open up her archives on these matters. The evidence outside the Vatican's archives indicates that the papacy encouraged, supported, and collaborated with both the Mussolini and Hitler regimes, as well as setting up its own totalitarian state in Croatia during the war. Since the Roman State Church is herself an authoritarian institution in which none of the rulers is elected by the people, in which power flows from the top down, and in which there is to be no disagreement with the leadership, she has shown an affinity for civil governments that reflect her own totalitarian and authoritarian structure, governments made in her own image. Writing in the New Individualist Review in 1965, Stephen J. Tonser pointed out the hostility of the Roman State Church to Republican Germany after World War I and her support for Nazi Germany. Quote, "There is the fact that German Catholicism was hostile to the Weimar Republic, that it marshaled its great power against the ideological and social pluralism, the liberalism, the democracy, the secular tone of Weimar Germany. The Church's vision was dominated by the ideal of an authoritarian state whose object was the promotion of virtue and true religion. The fountainhead and stronghold of the Nazi movement in Germany was Bavaria in South Germany, Roman Catholic Germany, not Protestant North Germany. German Catholics joined the Nazi Party en masse and enthusiastically supported the Hitler regime. They were accustomed to authoritarian government in their religious lives, which made them unquestioning and enthusiastic supporters of authoritarian civil government as well. Of course, Roman Catholic laymen were simply following the example and the instructions of their religious leaders. Pius XI was the first head of state to recognize Hitler's government in 1933. Pius XI praised Hitler in public, even before he extended official recognition to the Hitler regime. In 1933, Pius XI told Hitler's vice chancellor, Fritz von Papen, also a Roman Catholic, how pleased he was that the German government now had at its head a man uncompromisingly opposed to communism. In July 1933, the Roman State Church signed a treaty with Hitler, guaranteeing the loyalty of German Catholics to the Hitler regime. One of the Romanist bishops in Germany, Berning, published a book stressing the link between Romanism and German patriotism and sent a copy to Hitler as a token of my devotion. German Monsignor Hartz praised Hitler for having saved Germany from the poison of liberalism and the pest of communism. Now, when they say liberalism, they don't mean what we mean by liberalism. They mean limited government, classical liberalism in its 19th century sense. That is, a government whose duty is the punishment of criminals. That's what they mean by liberalism. The Roman state church military bishop endorsed the Nazi goal of Lebensraum. In fact, one of the footnotes in here shows that the Pope himself indirectly endorsed that Nazi goal in his Christmas Eve message, December 24, 1941. He said, "It's entirely justifiable when nations who are not allowed to get access to the resources they need, it's entirely understandable that war would occur." An indirect justification of what Hitler was doing. Lebensraum. It was no wonder then that the Roman Catholic publicist Franz Teichner praised the Führer, gifted with genius, and declared that he had been sent by Providence in order to achieve the fulfillment of Catholic social ideas. Tonser, referring to the previous article, writes, "In accommodating to National Socialism through the Concordat of July 1933, the Roman State Church put its stamp of approval upon a criminal regime and opened the way for recognition of that regime within Germany and abroad. The cooperation of the Roman State Church went well beyond the Concordat. The Roman State Church played an important role in the Saar referendum, in the remilitarization of the Rhineland, in the Austrian Anschluss, in the German war effort 1939 to 1945, and in the crusade against Soviet Bolshevism. The Catholic press in Germany was frequently little more than an extension of Goebbels' propaganda ministry, and German bishops and priests often spoke the party Chinese of the Nazis. Ultimately, the worst sins of the German Catholic Church and of the papacy were those of omission, the failure to speak out against racism, persecution, the violation of the peace, murder on a scale hitherto unknown in human history, in morally unambiguous terms. To be sure, there were infrequent statements from the German bishops and the papacy, but they were couched in the muted and esoteric language of encyclical Latin. If Jesus Christ had spoken this language, he might have been appointed to the Sanhedrin." Contrary to Tonser, however, the worst political sin of the Roman State Church was not her failure to speak out unambiguously against the Nazi regime, its wars of aggression and legalized murder of millions. After all, those were things that the Roman State Church herself had done and was theologically committed to doing again when the time was ripe. No, her worst political sin was the active support that the Roman State Church gave to the Hitler and Mussolini regimes. Of course, the Roman State Church did not then and does not now recognize her moral turpitude in this matter or any other. She cannot do so. She is infallible. Perhaps the few members got out of line, but not the church. An American Roman Catholic writer, Gordon Zahn, in a 1962 book, German Catholics and Hitler's Wars, shows that, quote, "The German Catholics supported Hitler's wars not only because such support was required by the Nazi rulers, but also because his religious leaders formally called upon him to do so. By example and open encouragement, the Catholic press and the Catholic organizations gave their total commitment to the nation's cause. The political thought of the Roman State Church, in which the interests of the individual are sacrificed for the common good, found an echo in the political thought of the Nazis. The 1933 Fulda pastoral letter from the German Catholic bishops read, quote, "Only if the individual sees himself as a part of an organism and places the common good ahead of individual good will his life once again be marked by the humble obedience and joyous service that Christian faith demands," unquote. In the pastoral letter, the Roman State Church's own authoritarian structure was offered to German Catholics as a model to support their submission to the Hitler government. Adolf Hitler was himself a Roman Catholic. Hitler had been reared in a traditional Catholic family. As a child and youngster, little Adolf had regularly attended Mass, had served as an acolyte during Mass, had hoped to become a priest, and had attended school in a Benedictine monastery at Lambach. The abbot of the monastery was involved in the occult and Eastern mysticism, And there Hitler first discovered the Hindu swastika that he later adopted as a symbol of his National Socialist movement. As an adult, Hitler remained a member in good standing in the Roman State Church. At no time did officials of the State Church excommunicate him. When the German military plotted to assassinate Hitler in 1944 and the plot failed, the Roman State Church in Germany offered a Te Deum to thank God for Der Führer's escape. As for Benito Mussolini, the Roman Catholic fascist dictator, his policy of political reconciliation with the Roman State Church culminated in the Lateran Treaties in 1929, in which Italy solved the Roman question, which had long plagued it, by recognizing the extraterritorial status of the Vatican. The Catholic Church, on the other hand, committed itself to collaborate with the fascist regime, which in turn recognized Catholicism as the dominant faith. The Lateran Treaties of 1929 restored the political status of the Roman State Church by recognizing her sovereignty over Vatican City, an area of 108 acres within the city of Rome. One American newspaper headline at the time was, "Wound Healed." According to Lacour, the Pope himself repeatedly referred to Mussolini as a man sent by divine providence and offered his full support for Mussolini's foreign political adventures. Even in the conflicts of the 1930s, meaning the invasion of Ethiopia, among other things, the Roman State Church's complaints were directed not against fascism as such, but merely against its attempt to curtail the Church's prerogatives. Not only did the Roman State Church support Hitler and Mussolini, she also created her own fascist state in Croatia. Lacour tells us that one species of fascism with a time-honored past had a recent revival and may have a promising future in some parts of the world. This is clerical fascism. And skipping over to page 44. Under the headline, Strategy for Subverting a Republic. Not being a republic or a democracy, but an absolute monarchy, the Roman State Church has been challenged by the age of democracies. During the modern age, the age shaped in part by the Reformation, its economic system capitalism, and its political system limited constitutional republics, the papacy realized that it would not be able to exercise its full powers for the time being. Leo XIII, who considered the situation extraordinary, as indeed it is in the history of the world, wrote, quote, "And although in the extraordinary condition of these times, the Church usually acquiesces in certain modern liberties, not because she prefers them in themselves, but because she judges it expedient to permit them, she would in happier times exercise her own liberty," unquote. Realizing that she could not hope for the time being to direct political affairs as she had at one time, the Roman State Church, speaking through Leo XIII, who of course is the subject of the conference sponsored by Calvin College and the Acton Institute for the Study of Religion and Liberty, he expressed the policy of the Church in these words, "Yet with the discernment of a true mother, the Church weighs the great burden of human weakness and well knows the course laid down which the minds and actions of men are in this our age being born. For this reason, while not conceding any right to anything save what is true and honest, she does not forbid public authority to tolerate what is at variance with truth and justice for the sake of avoiding some greater evil or of obtaining or preserving some greater good." Now, you might want to read that quote a couple of times just to get the import of it. In this century, Monsignor Ronald Knox, he's a very prominent figure in Roman theology of England, reiterated Leo XIII's strategy for Romanist operations in a republic. Quote, "A body of Catholic patriots entrusted with the government of a Catholic state will not shrink even from repressive measures in order to perpetuate the secure domination of Catholic principles among their fellow countrymen. It is frequently argued that if Catholics have at the back of their system such notions of toleration," in quotes, It is unreasonable in them to complain when a modern state restricts, in its turn, the political or educational liberty which they themselves wish to enjoy. What is sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. The contention is ill-conceived. For when we demand liberty in the modern state, we are appealing to its own principles, not ours. When we demand liberty in the modern state, we are appealing to its own principles, not ours. A body of Catholic patriots will not shrink from repressive measures in order to perpetuate the secure domination of Catholic principles among their fellow countrymen. This is 20th century Catholicism. This is not the 13th century. In 1948, the Jesuit Cavelli explained Roman state church political strategy in a journal published by the Jesuits in Rome, The Catholic Citizen. The Roman Catholic Church, convinced through its divine prerogatives of being the only true church, must demand the right of freedom for herself alone, because such a right can only be possessed by truth, never by error. In a state where the majority of the people are Catholic, the Church will require that legal existence be denied to error, and that if religious minorities actively exist, they shall have only a de facto existence without opportunity to spread their beliefs. Realizing that for the time being the state church would have to put up with democratic governments, Leo XIII and his successors appealed to Roman Catholic laymen to advance the cause of the state church. For example, Leo wrote, "First and foremost, it is the duty of all Catholics worthy of the name and wishful to be known as most loving children of the church to reject without swerving whatever is inconsistent with so fair a title, to make use of popular institutions, so far as can honestly be done, for the advancement of truth and righteousness, to strive that liberty of action shall not transgress the bounds marked out by nature and the law of God, to endeavor to bring back all civil society to the pattern and form of Christianity which we have described." That pattern, of course, is the Middle Ages. These laymen, of course, are known as the Pope's divisions. To the extent that they obey the Pope, rather than think for themselves or be guided by Scripture, they constitute a fifth column in every nation on earth. They are the means by which the papacy has advanced its political agenda in the United States for 200 years. In Pacem in Terris, his 1963 encyclical, John the 23rd wrote, "The Catholics active in social, economic, and political affairs must always make decisions in accordance with the principles of the natural law, with the social doctrine of the Church, and with the directives of ecclesiastical authorities." Notice that list. The principles of the natural law, the social doctrine of the Church, and the directives of ecclesiastical authorities. This is John the 23rd, that nice, humble old man, grandfatherly type, much like our present Pope, speaking at the time of Vatican II. "For it must not be forgotten that the Roman State Church has the right and the duty not only to safeguard the principles of ethics and religion, but also to intervene authoritatively with her children in the temporal sphere, where there is a question of judging the application of those principles to concrete cases." Then there's a section following that. For world government, let me read a couple of these paragraphs, and then I'll open it up for questions. "The spirit of Antichrist has been working relentlessly for 2,000 years to achieve a worldwide consolidation of ecclesiastical and political power. What the Roman State Church accomplished on a small scale during the Middle Ages is what she desires to achieve on a global scale in the 21st century. But if she fails to reach her goal within the next 100 years, she won't quit. She will continue to work tirelessly for world power, even if it should take another two millennia. In her two social encyclicals of the 20th century, the Roman State Church has frequently called for world government. One of the major documents issued by the Second Vatican Council, Gaudium et Spes, is typical. It is our clear duty, therefore, to strain every muscle in working for the time when all war can be completely outlawed by international consent. This goal undoubtedly requires the establishment of a universal public authority, acknowledged as such by all and endowed with the power to safeguard on the behalf of all security, regard for justice, and respect for rights. This universal public authority is necessary for several reasons. Here the Roman State Church mentions three: security, justice, and rights. One of the more significant reasons for world government is to manage the world economy and redistribute goods from the rich nations to the poor nations. John Paul II wrote in 1987 to express, quote, his insistence on the most serious duty incumbent on the more developed nations to help the developing countries, unquote. The common good is the great fiction used by the Roman State Church to justify government control of society and economy. It is also useful in arguing for a world government, as many popes have done. The Catechism of the Catholic Church points out that, quote, human interdependence is increasing and gradually spreading throughout the world. The unity of the human family, embracing people who enjoy equal natural dignity, implies a universal common good. This good calls for an organization of the community of nations able to provide for the different needs of men, food, hygiene, education. All of this is driven by the pagan theological premise that the members of mankind share the same basic rights and duties as well as the same supernatural destiny. Because all men are joined together by reason of their common origin, their redemption by Christ, and their supernatural destiny, and all are called to form one Christian family, we appealed in the encyclical Mater et Magistra to economically developed nations to come to the aid of those which were in the process of development. Notice how they say that all men share the same supernatural destiny. This is the theological foundation for world government. The Roman State Church's grand design for world government rests on the fundamental assumption of the spiritual unity of the human race. Since it is world justice which is in question here, the unity of the human family must first of all be seriously affirmed. Christians find a sign of this solidarity in the fact that all human beings are destined to become in Christ sharers of the divine nature. Unquote. The Roman State Church sees herself as an unique institution that alone can accomplish this global unification. Moreover, since in virtue of her mission and nature, she is bound to no particular form of human culture, nor to any political, economic, or social system, the Roman State Church, by her very universality, can be a very close bond between diverse human communities and nations, provided these trust her and truly acknowledge her right to true freedom in fulfilling her mission. Few people understand the importance of the Roman State Church in contemporary international affairs. When the United States appointed an ambassador to the Roman State Church in 1984 during the Reagan administration, the Senate Committee on Foreign Affairs commented on the diplomatic significance of the Roman State Church in its report on the bill. The Vatican is an important player on the world stage. It maintains a diplomatic presence and has wide influence and access to important areas of great interest to the United States, such as Eastern Europe, Central America, Africa, and the Middle East. Vatican diplomats, widely regarded as among the most skilled in the world, play an active role in international political affairs. Less well known are the Vatican's day-to-day but very important activities related to issues across the whole spectrum of American concerns, including immigration policy, refugee resettlement, food and medicine distribution, narcotics control, and education. The committee noted that diplomatic recognition focuses on the Pope as chief of state of the Vatican City and not on his office as leader of the Roman Catholic Church. The last sentence quoted is, of course, a fiction, for Vatican City is only 108 acres and has a population of only a few hundred people. The only reason it's significant is that it is the headquarters of the Roman State Church, just as the Kremlin was the headquarters of the Soviet Union and the White House is the headquarters of the United States. The committee report betrays the real intention of the Senate by elsewhere and repeatedly referring to the new United States ambassador as the ambassador to the Holy See, not to Vatican City. The Holy See, embodying spiritual and temporal sovereignty, appears in the words of the New Catholic Encyclopedia as somewhat an anomaly in international law. That is, as the only religious institution engaged in diplomatic intercourse. As Richard mentioned earlier, I believe, the Vatican ambassador in various nations serves as the dean of ambassadors. That is, he is the first. He's given the highest respect by serving as dean of ambassadors in that nation. In 1957, the United Nations and the Holy See agreed to discontinue the usage Vatican City and to speak of the Holy See. The statement in the Senate report quoted above was apparently designed to placate and mislead those who oppose sending an ambassador to the Roman State Church as being a violation of the principle of separation of church and state. This anomaly, as the New Catholic Encyclopedia calls the Roman State Church, has taken every opportunity to advance its goal of world government. Paul VI in 1967 included an entire section titled Toward an Effective World Authority in his Encyclical Populorum Progressio. This international collaboration on a worldwide scale requires institutions that will prepare, coordinate, and direct it until finally there is established an order of justice which is universally recognized. Who does not see the necessity of thus establishing progressively a world authority capable of acting effectively in the juridical and political sectors? There is a need, wrote Paul VI, in the coming 80th, on the celebration of the 80th anniversary of Leo XIII's 1891 encyclical on the condition of the working classes, to establish a greater justice in the sharing of goods, both within national communities and on the international level. John Paul II elaborated, reasserting the state church's doctrines of solidarity and the universal destination of goods. When interdependence becomes recognized in this way, the correlative response as a moral and social attitude, as a virtue, is solidarity. This, then, is not a feeling of vague compassion or shallow distress at the misfortunes of so many people, both near and far. On the contrary, it is a firm and persevering determination to commit oneself to the common good, because we are all really responsible for all. This determination is based on the solid conviction that what is hindering full development is that desire for profit and that thirst for power already mentioned. In addition to the theological reasons why the world must be unified, world government is necessary because the moral order demands it. In order to manage the environment, to control multinational corporations, to end international free trade, to transfer massive amounts of wealth from rich nations to poor nations, to foster development and save the peace, and because national governments are incapable of ensuring the universal common good. In the judgment of the Roman State Church, the United Nations is, at the present time, the likeliest vehicle to achieve the political and economic world unification that the Roman State Church desires. The State Church has been lavish in her moral support for the United Nations. John the 23rd has referred to the UN Declaration of Human Rights as an act of the highest importance performed by the United Nations organization, approved by the General Assembly of December 10, 1948. It is therefore our ardent desire that the UNO, in its structure and in its means, may become ever more equal to the magnitude and nobility of its tasks, and may the time come as quickly as possible when every human being will find therein an effective safeguard for the rights which derive directly from his dignity as a person, and which are therefore universal, inviolable, and inalienable rights. Ayn Rand was exactly right when she wrote in 1967, The Catholic Church has never given up the hope to reestablish the medieval union of church and state with a global state and a global theocracy as its ultimate goal. The Roman state church is a monster of ecclesiastical and political power. Her political thought is totalitarian, and whenever she has had the opportunity to apply her principles, the result has been bloody repression. If, since the triumph of the Reformation, she has muted her assertions of full, supreme, and irresponsible power, and has murdered fewer people than before, such changes in behavior are not due to a change in her ideas, but to a change in her circumstances. Lord Acton noted a century ago that it was only when the Roman state church faced public opinion that disapproved of state church-sanctioned murder that she slowed her persecutions and attempted to speak with a voice less bloodthirsty. The Roman state church in the 20th century, however, is an institution recovering from a mortal wound. If and when she regains her power and authority, she will impose the most murderous regime that the planet has yet seen. Are there any questions or comments? I'm sorry that the gentleman isn't here this morning who asked me about Lou Rockwell and the Mises Institute. I made the comment offhand the other day that the leadership of the conservative movement in the U.S. is Catholic, and they know what is in the papal encyclicals. And if they disagree with those encyclicals, they will be disciplined by the church if they occupy civil office. The Pope has cracked down, Joseph Ratzinger has cracked down on anyone who disagrees with them. And just this year, they have expanded the binding nature of the what's called the ecclesiastical directives of the church, not just from those that have to do with faith and morals, but whatever the papacy says is binding on the conscience, on the will, and on the intellect of Catholics. Now, there are many Catholic laymen who might rebel at that. I would hope that they would. But I would not want to be put in a position where the future of the freedom of the U.S. rests upon some Catholic layman thumbing his nose at the Pope. Yes?
John, can you comment maybe on the fact that all these nations, as John Paul II, and other folks wanted us to redistribute our wealth to, were nations where the Roman Catholic economic policy and has left the people out of there?
Well, I'll get to that more in the next hour, Tim. But I think you've hit upon a very good point. That where the policies advocated by the Vatican have been put into effect most consistently and most thoroughly, they have wrecked the economies of nations, which are now prime candidates for foreign aid from the U.S. And the popes have called for strength for leaders of nations like the U.S. so that they will have the will and the courage to impose the high taxes necessary to achieve the transfer of wealth from North America, from Northern Europe, to the rest of the Catholic world. And the point is very well taken, Tim. That's exactly what they're doing. Yes, Ross.
I just want to ask if you could comment on any ways here in the United States in our history that the Roman Catholic Church has been repressed. Oh, clearly the minority here.
Yes, and that's the clue.
Yeah, there's a book by a man called Thompson on the Roman Church and civil power, which. The whole book just deals with the United States and the repression that has taken place from the beginning. And it's documented in different cardinals and bishops throughout the earlier part of the United States, where the United States objected to the Republic republican nature of the government of the United States, because it was had a checks and balances in it, and it did not agree with this. And there's a lot said. It could take a whole lecture to answer that question. We have a book which we could give reference to. We don't have it with us. It's out of print, but it can be obtained.
Go ahead, Charles.
Do you see parallel with the Christian Coalition as being pretty much either an overt or covert arm of the Catholic Church to bring about this transition?
I don't know enough about the inner workings of the coalition to speak to the issue, but it certainly is not doing any good in that regard. On Catholic repression in the U.S., I've tried to obtain some figures and could not do it on how much tax money is already transferred to Roman organizations. Now, that's not a form of repression, but it is a form of stealing. And as best as I can determine it, at the present time, it amounts to the hundreds of millions of dollars. In the future, should a program such as school vouchers be instituted, the transfer will increase into the billions of dollars. We had a gentleman here in August for a course I taught who is headmaster of a Christian school in Milwaukee. And he has 1,200 students in his school. And, of course, Wisconsin is one of those states in which they have recently instituted a voucher program. And the Christian schools, for the most part, oppose it. And the proponents of the program are the parochial schools, the Catholic schools, because they are, now that it's in place and the courts apparently have cleared the way for it, they will receive something like $5,000 per student from the government for educating kids in their school. It puts the Christian school in an untenable position. The Catholic, the parochial school, has no problem working with the government or accepting government directives. In many cases, the government is staffed by Catholics. The governor of Wisconsin is a Roman Catholic. So there's no problem for them. But when a Christian school accepts that voucher, it falls under the control of the government. And then it jumps through the government's hoops for its curriculum, for what's to be taught in the classes, for its hiring policies, and every aspect of the educational system. And if programs like that were to go into in force across the country or at the federal level, you would see the transfer run into the billions of dollars directly from the Treasury of the U.S. To Roman institutions. Yes, sir.
One of the items here, we're inundated all the time, now it's a global economy. Now things, you know, that's the way it's going to be, that's the axiom of the times. Oh yeah, age is teetering into other things, these things will be worked out. How will such a paradigm shift take place when we've been inundated with gap and all of those things? It's just the way the world works now, it's going to be your life.
Oh, you're assuming GATT is free trade. That's the premise I challenge. Free trade means you don't have governments involved or managing or subsidizing trade. GATT has all of those things. If we had free trade, there would be no need for GATT or any counterpart with any nation on earth. The fact that government is involved indicates that it's not free trade. Free trade means the absence of export subsidies, the absence of import subsidies, the absence of quotas, the absence of tariffs. It is the principles of a free economy applied to international trade.
So you're going back to the true meaning of the word.
I'm back to 19th century liberalism, yes.
Yeah. Real reality and free truth.
Yes. Yes, sir.
Back to this voucher, I guess. Would it not end up perhaps being a direct transfer to Rome, because the expenses associated with teaching a student in a parochial school, which nuns and people that receive a minimal amount of pay, or none at all, or subsistence, or whatever, that money would go directly to Rome? Would that be what's happening here?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by directly to Rome. In my paper on economics, I point out that under the canon law of the church, and Richard may have mentioned this as well, I don't know, under the canon law of the church, all property that a Catholic church has is owned by the Pope personally. He is the legal owner of all the property in the world. A recent, and I think I mentioned this the first night, a Supreme Court decision just recently regarding division of property among dioceses in the Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania area was upheld by the civil courts in the U.S. because under church law, the Vatican has the right to dispose of property, to use property in any way she sees fit. So any transfer to a Roman institution is legally a transfer to the Vatican. Any transfer of property. Unfortunately, some Pennsylvania Catholics don't understand that. They sued in civil court to prevent what the Vatican had approved. And that's why I made the comment that apparently they think they're attending a Baptist or a Congregational or a Presbyterian church. They simply do not understand the legal structure of the institution. All the property is owned by the Pope. He is the owner. He allows his agents, the bishops, the archbishops, the priests, to manage it. But he is the owner. Go ahead, Richard.
A two-part question. Are there any reform men who are really discerning the sociopolitical thought at the moment like you are? And the second part is, why is it that such as Rush Dooney and Gary North, and who are theonomists, who have studied the socio-political realities of our time, why is it, rather than exposing Catholicism, that we find that some of these men are working together with the Catholic Church?
Oh, well, your first question, I'm sure there are. In fact, many people are writing that have at least a good deal of the truth about political thought or social thought or economic thought. A retired college professor from Grove City, Tom Rose, he taught economics up at Grove City for a number of years. He's a member of the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. He has written some good things. Even Gary North, if you go back and read what he wrote 30 years ago, it's good stuff. I would say the same thing about Rush Dooney. Their best books were produced in the 1960s and early 1970s. Read, I'm sure it's out of print, or maybe Gary still has it in print, his Introduction to Christian Economics. It's not quite Christian, but it's very good economics. What I mean by that is he doesn't make the attempt to derive it solely from Scripture. He incorporates other sources of information as well. That's what I mean when I say it's not quite Christian. But they also have, it seems to me, an appreciation for some things in worship. Many of the people that came out of the Tyler Church in Texas, which was the great experiment in Reconstructionist ecclesiology, I guess, left and joined the Roman Church. And some went to other churches. They went to Episcopal churches. In fact, I think the church itself ended up finally as a Reformed Episcopal congregation. And they've had, in the pages of the Trinity Review, I've talked about some of their ideas in this regard. And in some cases, North himself has very thinly disguised what he would do if he were president, as it were. And it's very similar to what I read from Ronald Knox. That is, when we appeal to liberties for what we're doing, we're appealing to liberties of the modern state. We're not appealing to our own. Because if we were in power, there would be no such thing as freedom of religion. The First Amendment is a mistake because it allows what they derogatorily call a pluralistic society. I dislike a pluralistic society, but I'm not going to get a, what should we call it, a monolithic society by using repression. The gospel is to be preached, not to be imposed on people. And any view of politics which echoes in any way the Roman view is not a biblical view. And I don't know if that speaks to your question or not, Richard, but in those back issues of the Trinity Review, which we hope to have up on the web before the end of the year, you'll see lots of discussion about some of the political thought of Gary North and James Jordan and people of that sort. Yes, Tim.
Regarding your comment earlier about how, and in your paper about how the Roman State Church will take advantage of the guaranteed liberties of independent government.
They will not only take advantage, they will insist.
Yes. And then they'll raise through the ranks and they'll repress everybody else.
By their own stated intentions.
Yes. An example that has happened recently, on a much smaller level, but it indicates the same mindset. Some of you may be familiar with Mike Chambers' ministry, proclaiming the gospel for Roman Catholics. There's a web service for Christian ministries who have free web space so they can advertise their ministry and sell their books on the web. It's called Goshen. Has anybody heard of Goshen? Well, Goshen, sent out a free offer to everybody, saying everybody's welcome to put their service on the web. And Mike Chambers took advantage of that, as did many Roman Catholic ministries, because the Roman Catholic ministries in the beginning insisted, well, if it's free for Christian ministries, then it'll be free for us. And so they were allowed to have their web service as well. Then when they got on their free website, they all began to point that Mike Jenner was being divisive, and that it wasn't fair for Roman Catholics to have to tolerate an anti-Catholic on the web service that was providing them support. And they eventually got Mike Jenkins kicked off the show. And another example is when I was invited to speak on a radio station in Birmingham, which is a radio station run by Protestants, or produced Roman Catholics. And they invited me to be on the radio. And the morning of the radio show, they called me up to cancel it because the Roman Catholic listeners had called me complaining that I was going to be on the air. The Roman Catholic listeners insisted that if I was going to be on the show, that there should be a Roman Catholic priest in the studio with me. And so this had to be postponed for several months, and then they had a Roman Catholic priest on the air with them. And then a year later, that same radio station has offered and allowed a Roman Catholic ministry to have a one-hour radio show every week to play a Roman Catholic doctor. And, they invited me to be on the show. And then the Catholics squelched that and then insisted on having a 1 hour show for themselves every week. But it's that mindset that you described. It tilted all the way from the top, all the way down to the layer. They're all aware of it. They're all coming up to it. That's too late.
Well, Mr. Kendall brought me the October 10 issue of World Magazine, and I don't know how many of you have seen our ads, but we ran six display ads in World Magazine for the conference. And the editorial by Marvin Olasky in this issue is an attack on our ad. And the big issue in this case is money. He says, he talks about the difficulties of being a manager or an editor of a magazine and how they lost subscriptions because of our ad. And this is what he writes. He says, "My final example comes from our toughest call." Now, our ad, I presume you've seen it, is a fairly innocuous ad. It's not in this magazine. They waited until after our ad series had run before they published the editorials. It says, "My final example comes from our toughest call. Several years ago, we carried a series of ads from a Catholic publisher who aggressively challenged some Protestant thinking. Many of our Protestant readers were offended by that, but we followed through on our distinct approaches to editorial and advertising manner. Recently, we've run an ad for a conference taking this place this month on, quote, Christianity and Roman Catholicism, unquote. The very title of the conference is obnoxious to Roman Catholics. And some of the lecture titles are even more pointed. The ad has left us uncomfortable for two reasons. First, we all know there's a difference between disagreeing with someone and baiting that party with ornery language. I didn't realize Christianity and Roman Catholicism was ornery language, but apparently it is. Second, frankly, since we're looking for advertising dollars to hold down the subscription price, it particularly hurts when some ads actually lose money for us. That's been the case here. In the abstract, I relish provocative ads almost as much as I do provocative articles in the abstract. The rationale is revenue, but also education. I really do believe that iron can sharpen iron. The problem, though, is that words can be sticks and stones, breaking not bones, but the morale of readers. We'll scrutinize ads, but our desire is to maintain a mostly open forum. Notice the mostly. Will our subscribers understand this, or will we have more players coming and going? Now, they have not had the courtesy to communicate with me about the ads. This is the first I've heard of it. And this purports to be an evangelical Christian magazine. There you have again, he mentions earlier in the article, the fact that they receive lots of phone calls from Catholic readers who protested the presence of that ad in the magazine. They should expect to have Catholic readers because for about 3 years they used Bill Bennett's book as the premium to get subscriptions. Bill Bennett is head of the Catholic Campaign for America, the former Secretary of Education. That's where his sympathy lies, the Catholic Campaign for America. That's what he intends to do. I mean, it's very open. It's very clear. They don't hide their intentions.
John, if I could make a comment, having lived in the Socialist Republic of Vermont for 12 years, which is 90% Roman Catholic, on the first visit of the Pope to the United States, I made a classic mistake that will underline and illustrate all that John has said. We had started a business, a land development business, some 11 years ago. And part of land development is the permitting process whereby you go through your local zoning boards in an attempt to achieve your goal. Because I was teaching at our local Bible church at the time and wanted to say something about the Pope at Rome and his visit to the United States, I wrote a series of articles for our local newspaper, editorials. Simultaneously, we were, as a company, applying for permits for a piece of land that we wanted to subdivide. To make a long story short, our hometown newspaper did publish in the editorial section of the newspaper my articles. But we were destroyed at the local planning level as far as our permit process. And the way that we were destroyed was interesting. They kept putting us off. And every time we got close to a permit, they would find something wrong with it. And then they would put us off. And it ended up being a year and a half before we were finally able to appeal to proper authorities above the local level, and cost us thousands of dollars to achieve a permit that under normal circumstances would have taken two meetings of the Planning Commission. And I heard through the grapevine that the permit would have been ours had I not written those letters. 7 out of the 9 members of that board were Roman Catholics. And this is the way it works. And that's exactly what they're faced with in Northern Ireland right now. It's not so much a fear of having one United Ireland in the sense of a beautiful island state. It's a fear of losing your pension or having your property taken away from you because of this entire concept of the redistribution of the money that is so dominant in Roman Catholic states. When I talk with my friends in Northern Ireland, Christians, they don't want the violence. And they deplore the bombings and the use of violence. But at the same time, they're very concerned if there's a united Ireland, that the Roman Catholic state, which runs the Republic of Ireland, will then interfere with the free commerce in the north. And they've been free in their commerce, or relatively free, they're still under British rule. That's not the most engaging economic system either. But Rome would be worse, and that's their fear, is that you get cut off economically. And we certainly felt it full force. We were cut off economically. And now when you do get your permit and you do subdivide and you do develop something, who's going to buy it? You're essentially boycotted by the Roman Catholic community. Nobody buys. Word gets out. Nothing is said, just nobody buys. And this is precisely what happens to some businesses in Belfast who are opposed to the Republic. Nobody buys. You're just simply economically destroyed. And this is a subtle thing that happens over a period of time, but ultimately it does occur. And we have seen this in the state of Vermont over and over and over again. Vermont's extremely socialistic, and it's run by a Roman Catholic oligarchy, and it comes right down to the basics of bread and butter on the table in some businesses and local communities. So it underscores everything that you're saying.
Yes, sir. I'll give another illustration about the policies of World Magazine. I guess about a year or 18 months ago, we began running ads for the book that I had back there on the table on male headship. And in the ad, we listed a number of bullets that highlighted some of the topics covered in the book. And we ran about 3 ads, I suppose, and we got a call from someone at World Magazine asking us to change the ads. And I didn't talk to them personally, but the fellow at our church that handles this talked to them, and they wouldn't say exactly what it was. It said they were getting complaints about the ad for a book on male headship. But we refused to change the ad. We took out 2 or 3 more ads, and then we started getting phone calls from older ladies, and they were complaining about what they thought the book had to be about. It had to be an attack on women and so forth. Now, it turns out that these were nuns that had been given our phone number by World Magazine staff. And they were told that one of them finally confessed. I shouldn't use that word. One of them finally came clean and told us that they had complained to World Magazine repeatedly. World Magazine said that they had talked to us and we refused to change the ad or pull the ad. So with their continued complaints, they were given our phone number and told to call them yourselves, and that's what happened.
That's amazing. That is amazing.
See, why is it that the Roman Catholics are dictating to evangelical Protestant things and what they can and can't advertise, or what a Protestant
revenue
can?
Revenue.
Money.
Olasky says it exactly. Revenue. So revenue drives the editorial and the advertising policies of the magazine. Yes, Michael.
Psychological question. You refer to a number of pro-Catholic writers in there who recognize the causes of the Rome. How will you be able to reconcile that evil with they themselves for the name of the church?
I don't know, Michael, but you brought up an excellent point, because some of the best sources I discovered when I did research on this are Roman Catholic writers. Yeah, no Protestant writers of any significance write on the subject. I don't know whether it's because they don't know anything about it, they think it would be impolite to do so, or what the reason is, but it's Gordon Zahn there, who wrote about German Catholics and Hitler wars and Lord Acton himself. Acton remained I don't know much about Zahn, but Acton remained a Catholic all his life. He hated the papacy with a passion, but he wasn't given the gift of faith as Luther was. One wonders what might have happened if a man that learned in the middle of the 19th century had been given that gift, what impact it might have had. His writings were clear enough, and he was candid enough as an historian that, as I say, he was hired by Presbyterians to edit the North British Review and published much of his best material there. But I don't know the psychology involved. I don't know how it's rationalized, the continued membership in the organization. Many times it's just fear, I suppose, that, or a suspicion that maybe if I leave, I will be damned. Maybe Richard can speak to it.
I think the bottom line is that you presuppose that the Catholic Church has the means of salvation, and that if you leave her, you're outside the possibility of salvation. And it is very popular inside the Catholic Church to be anti-clerical and critical of the Catholic Church, and they allow it as long as you don't leave and as long as you continue to bow the knee. Inside the Catholic Church, it was quite popular to speak about the Catholic Church. I remember in Trinidad at a priest meeting saying that I did not want the papal spy to come to Trinidad. That was the papal representative. I said, we're doing quite well. When he came and I was introduced to him, I wouldn't shake his hand, which he took a bit of... I said, I just won't shake hand. I just don't accept you here in Trinidad. And I was still tolerated. Nobody said anything to me. It was still when I started talking about faith alone, grace alone, and the Bible only as authority, then I got real persecution. But it's very popular inside the church to speak against the church, and you can get sort of spiritual brownie points. You know, you're high enough up in the system to criticize the system. It's only when you start talking about biblical truths that you really get persecuted.
If you'll notice, Michael, that Zahn's book in particular was published by the University of Notre Dame Press. You know, they've been noted for their, what shall we say, their latitudinarianism out there in theology at Notre Dame. And it wasn't originally published by Notre Dame, but the reprint was done by Notre Dame several years afterward.
John, I think the partial answer to the question is the mindset that God had addressed, the idea of using logic to get to Rome, or some kind of otherworldly logic, otherworldly logic to get to Rome, and checking the door. It's that same sort of dichotomy that existed in the minds of the American people, that the moral behavior of the president doesn't have any impact on his power. Office, and they would say, I'm sure that Rome has all these terrible problems of moral character flaws, but they still have the means to execute their responsibilities as a church and providing these salvation.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that analogy. Bill is infallible but not impeccable, which is the Roman doctrine applied to civil office.